from the National Humanities Center. This is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. Artificial intelligence, the topic this week on Soundings. Can computers think? Contrasting responses to that question from two recent visitors at the National Humanities Center. First on this edition of Soundings, a conversation with John Searle of the University of California at Berkeley. Following that, a discussion featuring Herbert Simon of Carnegie Mellon University. John Searle, you're a philosopher at the University of California at Berkeley. We're going to talk about philosophy of mind and artificial intelligence. What's the big deal? What are people fighting about?
Well, there's an awful lot going on in this whole field. One of the most amazing claims that people have made over the past, 30 years now, is that by designing a computer program and running it on a digital computer, they will literally have a machine that thinks.
And you don't agree with that?
Well, it isn't that I don't agree with it. It's conceptually false. That is, it's like saying 2 plus 2 equals 5. I mean, the refutation of that is so simple that we can give you the refutation in one sentence. So the only interest that it has is, well, what's the significance of the refutation and why would people have said this in the first place? So let me tell you about that.
Well, let's get a couple of definitions on the table first, John Searle. Very, very briefly, I mean, we're talking about an immensely complicated topic,
right?
Artificial intelligence.
Right.
How does the brain work? How do computers work?
Okay. Well, now let me go back to computers. I've been talking about artificial intelligence. We call it AI. That's among in the family. That's what we call it.
Okay.
And I like to distinguish in AI between what I call strong AI, that says by designing the right program, you're literally creating a mind, because that's all there is to having a mind, is having the right program. Mm-hmm. So on the strong AI view, the mind is to the brain as the program is to the hardware. So if you design the right program and you run it on our wetware is a kind of hardware, the brain for these guys is a kind of hardware that runs a program. If you design the right program, you would literally have created a mind, because that's all there is to having a mind. Now that's the view I call strong AI, and that's the view I'm going to refute. Now I want to distinguish that from weak AI, which says, look, the computer is a wonderful tool. Let's use it to study human beings. And I have no objection to that. By all means, use the computer to study fires, rainstorms, economic developments. You can use a computer for anything. I have no objection to weak AI, and I certainly have no objection to the practical applications. I wouldn't be here today if the computer hadn't printed out my airline tickets and made my reservations and run the airplane. Of course, I couldn't live without computers. But strong AI is the interesting view. Now, let me refute strong AI and then get into the contrast between how the brain works. We know a little bit about how the brain works
now.
And contrast that with the way that computers work. The thesis is, if you run the right program in a machine, that machine will literally have thoughts and feelings in exactly the same literal sense that you and I do. It will understand things in the same sense and you and I do. It will have all of our psychological, cognitive, mental, conscious capacities. Here's the very simple refutation that I promised you. Just imagine that you are the computer, that you're the hardware, and we give you a program, and you go through the steps in the program for some cognitive capacity. I like to pick something that I don't know how to do, speak Chinese. So let's imagine that you're locked in a room, and they design a program that will enable you to answer questions in Chinese. The way the program works is, you're there locked in the room, and you get in some Chinese symbols, and you look up at the program what you're supposed to do, and you shuffle the symbols. You put one next to another and go through a series of these symbol steps. That's what computers do. They go through these formal symbol manipulating steps. And then you have a rule that says, now you give them back a Chinese symbol. Mm-hmm. So you got Chinese symbols coming into the room, and you're shuffling them around and putting Chinese symbols back out of the room.
Oh, what's wrong with that?
Yeah, what's wrong with it is very simple. You don't understand Chinese. That is, we suppose that the symbols that come in are questions, and the symbols that you give out are perfect answers to the questions. Chinese people on the outside of the room, seeing the questions they ask you and the answers you give back, would say, that guy's a perfect speaker of Chinese. He understands the question perfectly, and he answers the question perfectly. But this is one thing wrong.
You don't understand a word of Chinese.
You're making the distinction between linguistics, semantics on the one hand, formal kinds of things, and for lack of a better term, meaning on the other hand.
No, it isn't semantics.
What is it?
Versus meaning, it's the syntax.
Uh-huh.
Now, notice what we've done here. We have given you in the Chinese room all that a computer has. You have the formal symbol manipulating rules which any computer has. What do you lack? You lack a knowledge of the meanings.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the point of this is the bottom line, the punchline of this is, if you don't understand Chinese on the basis of running the computer program for understanding Chinese, then neither does any other digital computer understand Chinese or anything else solely on the basis of running a digital computer program, because that's all that the computer has. The computer hasn't got anything mm-hmm. that you don't have. Now, what is it that you lack? You just said it, and that is you don't know the meanings. Yeah. You don't have the semantics. And so the refutation of strong AI, I can put in four words. Syntax is not semantics.
All right.
The program has a formal syntax. The program is a series of formal symbol manipulating devices.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
Now, the beauty of the argument I gave you is that it has nothing to do with any state of technology. Imagine any future state of technology where you have much more rapid computational processes, where you have parallel processes, where you have parallel distributing processes. The point of the Chinese room argument is a mathematical point. It has nothing to do with the state of technology. What it says is, since by definition, the program is a system of formal symbol manipulation,
mm-hmm.
the program by itself will never be a mind, because the mind's got something more than formal symbols.
All right, now, you use the word definition, John Searle.
Yeah.
Let's redefine the terms. Be what? Indulgently charitable for a moment.
Yeah.
Tell me the strengths of the arguments that the people are advancing who say, yes, indeed, there is such a thing as artificial intelligence. Let's look at it from that
angle.
Okay,
now let's try their angle. In one sense, I want to say, if by intelligence you mean the capacity to behave intelligently, then of course there's artificial intelligence. I mean, any pocket calculator, any wristwatch
will do what
any thermostat on the wall will behave as if it were intelligent. I mean, that's why we have these machines. But now, look, at some point we ought to talk about the brain, because I think that's really where these guys are making a deep mistake.
Speaking of bad analogies.
Yeah.
Huh?
Right.
Are
yeah.
we on the right track with that?
Yeah. So we turn to the brain now. Let me just summarize what I said about AI, though, for the benefit of our listeners. There's no objection to weak AI, the idea that you use the computer, or the idea that to study the mind, or the idea that you can develop machines that behave intelligently. That's what it's all about. I mean, that's what we're paying so much money for this machinery, and it's worth it. I love it. The big mistake is to suppose that by designing a program, you're creating a mind.
Mm-hmm.
And that mistake is a mistake of confusing the level of the symbols with the level of the meanings. Once you see that minds have mental contents, and that programs are purely formal, and that the formal syntax by itself isn't enough for the mental content, that the syntax isn't sufficient for the semantics, then it just follows conceptually,
yeah.
follows logically, strong AI is false. Programs are not minds. They suppose that there is something abstract, something immaterial called the mind, and then they wonder, how could it be in a physical substance such as the brain? And the only answer that has ever been proposed to something, how some abstract semantics could ever function causally in a physical system, is the way that the abstract computer program is realized in the physical system of the computer hardware. So, and by a weird historical perversion, traditional dualism, the idea that the mind is not a piece of ordinary biology, but is something formal, abstract, immaterial, that has now popped up again in strong AI.
Hmm.
And it's very ironical, because a lot of these guys take themselves to be anti-dualistic, anti-Cartesian. But in fact, one way to see strong AI is it kind of the last dying gasp of this Cartesian dualism.
Yeah.
But the things we really want to know, we don't know the answers to. How does memory work?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when I saw you today, I recognized you immediately. Now, how does that work? That's a remarkable capacity if you think about it, because I haven't seen you for a long time. I can recognize hundreds, maybe thousands of people, and yet instantly,
Bingo.
As soon as I saw you, I recognized you immediately. Now, we don't know how that works. We haven't the faintest idea how that works. I mean, maybe we think there's a certain part of the brain where it's localized, but the only reason we think that is that people who get holes in that part of their brain, they get lesions, are unable to recognize other people's faces. Anyway, we don't. Why are we conscious? I mean, both of us are conscious right now. It's an amazing thing, you see. I mean, the other matter in this room, the tables and chairs, they're not conscious. Now, what is it about the process in our brain that causes consciousness? Or why do we need sleep? Every so often, you and I just have to lie down and go to sleep. Why? Nobody knows. I mean, you can't say, well, our muscles need rest. Our heart doesn't get sleep. Our heart goes all the time.
Yeah.
Why is it that we need sleep? I mean, on all kinds of silly or trivial things that you'd think we know the answer to, we don't know the answer to. Why does alcohol make us drunk?
Chemical properties.
Yeah, but what? What exactly?
One set of chemical properties operating on another.
Indeed. Now tell us exactly the chemistry of it. What? I mean, of course, it's the chemistry of alcohol, and we know that. I mean, the carbon rings and all that. I mean, the structure of alcohol, yeah. The different kinds of alcohol, that's been known to every college chemistry text. But how exactly does that produce the feelings that go with drunkenness? Nobody knows the answer.
Well, it isn't necessarily one chemistry on one side and another chemistry on the other. It's that moment of interaction. And here's where we have that problem with what's abstract and what is material.
Well, yeah, but what we would like to know is what exactly is the nature of the interaction? Mm-hmm. And now, and this is the hard part, how does the interaction produce the feeling? Mm-hmm. How does the physiology produce the psychology? And there we know something about the neurophysiology of pain. We know a lot more than we used to know about visual perceptions. But when you get up there in the telencephalon, you get up in the frontal lobes especially, we don't really know what's going on. I mean, we do not know how the intellectual parts of our brain, how thinking, consciousness, cognition, memory, we really don't know how they work. All right, but now that we do know enough to see the deep mistake that's being made by these guys in AI, and indeed, in a way, it's the mistake of our culture, and it's this. We know enough to know that all of this stuff, all of our mental stuff, is caused by processes in the brain, and it's actually going on in the brain. We don't need to postulate some mysterious abstract entity. These mental processes are just higher level processes in the brain. And of course, for that reason, they're higher level physical processes in the brain.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's hard for us even to say that because we got this vocabulary that contrasts the mental and the physical, the mind with the body, the thought with the machinery. But what I'm trying to argue is if you think about the physiology, think about the biochemistry of it, you'll see that the mind just is a feature of the brain. See, we can make a model of digestion at any level you like. I mean, we can do a computer model of the way the enzymes attack the stuff that you eat and so on, but it won't digest pizza. I mean, when you're running the computer program for digestion, it gives you a perfect model of digestion. So you might have a perfect model of how the stomach digests pizza. But now take a great big pizza and stuff it in a computer. It isn't going to digest. It's ridiculous. Now, that's exactly how it is with the mind.
All right.
I mean, you had a perfect model of how the brain produces consciousness. But what the model is, any model, this is a formal model. It's like a picture. You can have a perfect model of how the brain produces consciousness. But of course, that isn't going to produce consciousness if it's just a mathematical model.
Mm-hmm.
So what computer modeling does, and as I say, I love computer modeling. I think it's terrific. But you can do models of fires or rainstorms or digestion or anything you like.
But it ain't the real thing.
But it's not the real thing. And it's exactly the same way with consciousness and thought processes. Don't confuse the simulation with the reality. Don't confuse the description with the thing described.
John Searle, let's conclude our conversation. Let me be, again, a little contentious with you. You're a philosopher at the University of California at Berkeley. Are you speaking from the standpoint of vested interests here? Are you worried about the decline of philosophy in the sense that artificial intelligence is, at some point, somehow or other, a threat to this enterprise?
Actually, I don't believe in these disciplinary boundaries. I'm a member of the cognitive science group, and these are words like science and philosophy and all that. Those are for university deans. I mean, our bureaucrats are fundraisers. I'm in the business of thinking, and that's what I get paid to do, is to try to think things out. And I work with computers a lot, and a whole lot of people are saying false things about computers. But falsity and truth have nothing to do with disciplinary boundaries. Have none to do with whether or not they're said in the name of philosophy or science or religion or anything else. I mean, there's the truth, and then there's a lot of other stuff going on that I won't tell you all the names of. But I'm just interested in trying to get at the truth.
John Searle is a professor of philosophy at the University of California at Berkeley. He serves as a member of the Board of Trustees of the National Humanities Center.
John Searle is the author of Speech Acts, an essay in the philosophy of language, published by Cambridge University Press. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings on Artificial Intelligence continues. My guest now is Herbert Simon of Carnegie Mellon University. Herbert Simon's most recent publications include Scientific Discovery, Computational Explorations of the Creative Process, issued by the MIT Press in 1987. Herbert Simon, welcome to the National Humanities Center. Let's talk about artificial intelligence. Can computers think?
Yes, computers have been thinking for about 30 years now.
The way human beings think?
Yes, the way that human beings think. Maybe we ought to define a few terms here. Now, I am perfectly willing to grant that you think. Of course, I know that I think, but I'm willing to grant that you think, and the reason I am...
You're going to make some assumptions.
I can observe your behavior. I can give you tasks. You can perform those tasks. That's the way we tell that human beings think. And if we give computers the same tasks, and we find that the computers are able to respond to them intelligently, then we either have to change the definition of thinking, or we have to say that computers think. Now, you asked a second part of that question. You said, in the way that we humans think. It's not real easy to find out what that way is, but psychology has been studying the ways of thought for a long time. There are various kinds of things we can observe. For example, we can set a person to work on a problem. We can ask them to think aloud. Some of us think aloud even when we're not asked to. We like to talk to ourselves when we're working. But most people, if asked to do that, can think aloud while they're doing a problem, and we find out second by second what they're attending to, what they're paying attention to, what they're doing, what processes they're engaging in. Then if we have a computer program that can do the same tasks, we can ask whether it's going through the same processes, whether it follows the same paths, whether it makes the same errors. Computers think by manipulating patterns that are inside the black boxes. They happen to be patterns of magnetism and electricity. And they can take in those patterns, what we call reading or input. They can give out patterns by printing them on a sheet of paper. They can store various structures of patterns. They can compare patterns to see whether they're the same or different and act one way if they're the same and another way if they're different. Those are the things that computers can do. We call those patterns symbols usually because they have reference to they denote things that are outside. To the best of our knowledge, through the psychological research we've done on human thinking, that's exactly the way human beings do it, by manipulating patterns, which in that case are stored in the head, ways we don't know very in much detail yet, but stored in the head somehow or other in neurons and collections of neurons, and which are operated on by rather slow electrochemical processes.
Compared to the human brain, for example.
No, the human brain is very slow compared to the computer.
I see. Herbert Simon, let me put this to you when we talk about artificial intelligence. If nature created human intelligence, God created human intelligence, however you want to discuss first causes, and then humanity comes along and invents computers. To say artificial intelligence, are we talking about an inferior form of intelligence? Are we talking, for example, with computers, are we talking about a third generation, as it were, and therefore one that is inferior somehow or other to the human ability to compute?
Well, at present, the examples we have of computer intelligence are rather specialized. That is to say, computers generally only know something about one thing. There are people like that, too. The computers we have at present are rather deprived. They live in a very lean sensory environment. They don't have much access to the world except the access we give them, and that's one reason for their specialization. Whereas human beings have at least a little knowledge, a smattering of quite a lot of things, including the things of everyday life. Now, in that sense, present computer intelligence is very inferior. It has nothing to do with the hardware. We don't need any new innovations in computer hardware in order to bring along the intelligence. What we do need are some computers who know much. You notice I used who rather than that, as you can do either. Some computers who are that know much more than any present computers do about the real world. And there's some efforts now to build very large memory banks for computers that will allow us to test out at least the question of whether that will give them the kind of generality in their intelligence that is still a distinguishing characteristic of human intelligence. See, nowhere in science do we prove that scientific theories are right. All we know is that we have a certain mechanism which, if it were the right mechanism, would explain what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And until somebody comes along with a better mechanism, or until we get some new facts which show that this mechanism is the wrong one,
yeah,
we believe the theory.
All right, fair enough. In other words, it's a sort of an existential thing. For now, we know that computers are XYZ sophisticated,
okay,
and we can assume that in the future they're going to become more sophisticated.
Right. And the level of their sophistication right now includes the following sorts of things. There is at least one computer program which is able to make medical diagnoses in the domain of internal medicine at a good clinical level of quality.
Mm-hmm.
It is borderline as a simulation of human thinking. It does probably a little more spinning of its wheels than a human diagnostician does, but it basically, as far as we know, the diagnostician's processes uses the same processes, including processes which we would ordinarily call intuitive. There are computer programs now which are capable of taking data, looking at those data, and finding laws in the data, something that scientists frequently get their pictures in history books for doing.
Let me ask you to pause on a word you just used, intuitive. You seem perfectly calm and rational and collected as you use that term. To some people, that might raise the signal. That might sound like a very sinister thing, that computers are developing an intuition, that they are beginning to think, we can push this thing to apocalyptic lengths.
Yes.
Is that the kind of thing that we need to, how do we need to be concerned about that when we talk about computers thinking?
Well, every day in this world, a large number of people are being born. I forget the number, it must be tens of thousands of people in the world. Each one is born capable of thinking, or at least acquiring the capacity for thinking. I don't lie awake nights very often being concerned about all those new intelligences being born in the world. Now, why should I be particularly concerned if some of those intelligences were embodied in the boxes we call computers?
Well, possibly because there are other people who might program those computers.
Yes.
That they will not necessarily assume an independent life of their own, that they're going to be programmed, and that the people doing the programs may, in fact, not have your interests at the center of their thinking. That's why you ought to be concerned.
Of course, that's also true of the kids who are being born.
Uh-huh.
I don't know whether you want to use the word programmed, but they're growing up in a particular culture,
uh-huh,
and several of the most populous cultures in our globe have values which are very different from my values.
Uh-huh.
So if I'm going to worry about those computers being programmed, I better worry about those kids too.
All right, fair enough. If we are headed toward what, on the distant horizon, a time when computers can and do think, tell me about the benefits, the perils and rewards of a situation like that. Where are we heading, America as a culture, if we're moving toward computers that think for us, or think?
Yeah, I'm glad you amended that. I'm going to have to answer that in a way which might seem evasive. I don't think it's evasive. It's as good an answer as I can give. When you're doing any kind of basic science, what you're doing is creating new knowledge. And with new knowledge, you're creating new human capacities to change the world, to do things, new instrumentalities. And we have ample evidence that when you create basic knowledge, you really don't have the capacity to predict just how that knowledge is going to be used. When E equals MC squared came along down the pike, Newton's famous equation, I'm sure he didn't have in mind atomic bombs.
Mm-hmm.
Although that probably...
Einstein or Newton?
Einstein.
Okay.
Excuse me, did I say Newton? I got it a little early. Einstein. I'm sure he didn't have in mind atomic bombs, although that probably occurred to him not very long afterwards. But it's very hard to predict how new knowledge is going to be used by human beings, because other human beings are going to use their ingenuity to figure out how to use that new knowledge in many, many directions.
That's an act of faith.
So anybody doing basic science, I think, has to really look back in history and say, on the average, by and large, is it better for there to be more knowledge in the world or less knowledge in the world? Has knowledge contributed to human progress or the well-being of the human species, or has it detracted? Now, that gets us into even more difficult problems of what's progress and all that. But taking a very common-sensey view, I like to think of it that my view, taking that view, I look back in human history And I don't find that I really would have preferred living in Roman times, or even Greek times, which I would prefer to Roman, I guess, or medieval times, or 19th century times. I really think that one can define certain senses in which the human species has progressed, and I see a very close relation between that and the growth of knowledge. So granted all of the ways in which knowledge has also caused harm in this world, I guess on balance I vote for knowledge rather than ignorance. And I do that knowing that I really don't have any crystal ball that tells me how artificial intelligence is going to be used. It's mm-hmm. going to be used for some good things, I think, some bad things. And I have a kind of basic optimism that the good are going to outweigh the bad.
Herbert Simon, let's conclude our conversation about artificial intelligence and put a very large issue on the table. Is there an ideology of artificial intelligence?
I don't see any particular ideological issues related to artificial intelligence. As a matter of fact, I spent a fair part of my life in the last 10 years in China, and one part of that part of my life was spent in working with Chinese scientists who are very interested in artificial intelligence and doing it in their country. So I don't see that this is a first world, second world, third world issue. It is true that a wealthy country has the capabilities of building electronics devices, of having a high technology, but I don't see that this necessarily excludes the benefits or the activity from the third world. As a matter of fact, one might argue, for example, that medical diagnosis systems, take my earlier example, that medical diagnosis systems might be of much more use to the Chinese, who now have to deal with barefoot doctors out on the communes, than it would be in the United States, where we have at least a fairly dense distribution of doctors all around the country.
Mm-hmm. Herbert Simon is a professor at Carnegie Mellon University. He was awarded the Nobel Memorial Prize in Economics in 1978 and the National Medal of Science in 1986. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings on Artificial Intelligence is available on cassette. Send $4 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Ask for program number 409. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. When writing, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Next week on Soundings, conversations about the origins and methods of biblical scholarship and about feminist theology. My guests will be William Hallow of Yale University and Rosemary Radford Ruther of Garrett Evangelical Theological Seminary. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Partial support for Soundings comes from The Leader, News of the Research Triangle. Major funding for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Can machines think? Artificial intelligence, the topic this week on Soundings. Contrasting answers from John Searle of the University of California at Berkeley and Herbert Simon of Carnegie Mellon University. John Searle is an expert in the philosophy of mind. Herbert Simon is a recipient of the Nobel Memorial Prize in Economics. Thinking Machines and Artificial Intelligence, some answers and insights this week on Soundings.